Republic City, Dicho. Corwin and Utna were no strangers to the concept of the grand day out. In the 5+ years they'd known each other, they'd had more than their fair share of them. The best ones, they both agreed, were the ones where they hadn't started with a plan, but just let the day evolve naturally. They took the same tack this time, and the result was a day to look back on and smile forevermore. Downtown by the railway station, they found that the city's semi-formal open-air marketplace was just emerging from its winter hibernation. It hadn't yet achieved its full flowering, but it was already a happening enough place that they could spend an hour or so roaming its stalls and kiosks, assembling various bits and pieces for the next phase of the day's operations. At one point, while Corwin was off prowling the still fairly skeletal farmer's market area, Utna was having a fine time haggling cheerfully with a woman named Kemba from one of the water tribes, she wasn't sure which one, over a blanket not unlike the one on the bed in the Phoenix House's Avatar suite. Utna was at a moderate disadvantage in these negotiations, since she had only a tenuous grasp of the local currency's actual value. But she and the blanket lady were both having fun with it anyway. She'd talked her down to 25 yuans by the time Corwin found her again. He stood off to one side and watched as she concluded the deal with a handshake, paid 22.5 yuans, and accepted the blanket with a smile. "That's a handsome boy you've got there," said Kemba, her eyes twinkling. "He needs to get more sun, though. He's very pale." Utna grinned. "How do you know we're together?" she asked. "Your bracelets," said Kemba, gesturing. "What else could they mean? Beautiful craftsmanship, too," she added. "May I?" Sure, said Utna, and the vendor took her right hand and brought it closer to examine the bracelet she wore. Utna agreed with her. They were beautiful. She'd caught herself pausing to admire hers about 100 times in the 24 hours or so she'd had it at this point. And she'd spent at least 9 of those hours asleep. A broad band of some metal that looked like, but she was reasonably sure wasn't, silver. It bore an intricate, highly stylized carving of a pair of dragons confronting each other, their tails intertwined in a manner reminiscent of Celtic knotwork on the other side. It fit snugly but not tightly around her wrist, like a well-fitted wristwatch, and had no evident clasp or hinge. "Very beautiful work," said Kemba with satisfaction, releasing Utina's hand. "My cousin Kiva is a silversmith. I'll have to mention this idea to her. Much more substantial than those little finger rings they use in the East," she added smugly. "Is that the way they're doing it up north these days?" Utna smiled. "Something like that," she said. "But where's your necklace?" Kemba asked with sudden concern. "Don't tell me he didn't make you one." She looked past Utna at Corwin, her expression accusing. "For shame, lad! Do they teach you youngsters nothing of the traditions at the North Pole any longer?"
"I'm not actually," Corwin began. But Utna overran him with a cheery laugh.
"I know, he's hopeless," she agreed, patting Kemba's forearm. "But I decided to keep him anyway. He's good at other things," she added with a wink that got a conspiratorial laugh from the blanket lady and a mild blush from Corwin.
"I'll just go and..." "Yeah," he said, sidling away, then making a break for it as soon as he'd reached minimum safe distance. He was arranging things in the back of the car, which Utna had almost instantly dubbed the Coromobile, when she rejoined him a few moments later. She hugged him from behind before placing the blanket she'd just purchased on the floor behind the driver's seat so it wouldn't blow around, and hopping back into said seat.
"You enjoyed that," Corwin said mildly as he climbed into the passenger seat.
"Yes, I did," Utna replied cheerfully, commencing the starting procedure more smoothly this time. I don't know what she was talking about exactly, but... She set the fuel pump control, then paused to retrieve a small, purse-like leather pouch from her jacket pocket and hand it to him. She gave me this to give to you, would not take no for an answer. Something about giving you one more chance to do it properly. Corwin considered the item for a moment, then tucked it away inside his own jacket, chuckling. Top of my to-do list, he said. In the meantime, he added, drawing a slightly crumpled sheet of paper from the same pocket and unfolding it, I found this flyer on a light pole near the farmer's market. I think it's our plan for tonight after dinner. Utina switched the magnetos to both, then took the sheet and regarded it. The Velvet Palanquin presents Saturday Night Jazz, she read, featuring... She blinked, then looked from the paper to Corwin's grinning face. You're kidding me. He shook his head, took the paper back, and repocketed it. Nope, take a look, they're all over the poles down here. Utina touched her fingertips together experimentally, then set the spark advance. The paste is still wet, she said. Where to now? Corwin waited until after the engine had roared back to life and settled down to its low, grumbling idle, then pointed down the block. Hang a right down there and look for Highway 14, he said. It's a great road. Goes up into the mountains. She grinned, pulling away from the curb. Like the Alfheim High Road, she said happily. Awesome. The road into the mountains northeast of Republic City was everything Corwin had implied, a ribbon of beautifully maintained tarmac that twisted thrillingly up one side of a steep river valley. Here, Utina cemented her relationship with the Coromobile, learning exactly what the limits of the car were. It was a bigger, heavier automobile than her own beloved CX-68 Cobra 2+2, with tall, narrower wheels that spoke of an earlier generation of motoring, and its vast V12 torque had to be handled with respect. The steering was very heavy, and operating the gear shift lever left her in no doubt that she was banging big pieces of metal together somewhere beneath it. This was a car from the days, not so long ago in Dicho, when machines were machines, and wrangling it on this challenging road was a real workout. She adored it unconditionally. As they had on a long-ago summer morning in Asgard, they pulled off the main highway and up a narrow, even twistier sidetrack Corwin pointed out. This led them to a very similar sort of scenic overlook, except this one, perched on a crag behind guardrails and backed by a fragrant piney wood, overlooked not the golden city of the gods, but instead what Utina had heard called the Avatar's City of Peace. The Coromobile's hood was too narrow and bumpy to sit on, so they spread Utina's new blanket on the grass next to the car and ate their picnic lunch on it instead, Corwin taking items from the basket he'd bought first thing and spreading them out like a waiter. Cheese, strange fruits, smoked meats, and some truly spectacular bread. All that was missing was that golden Asgardian beverage whose name Utina had never managed to learn. The bottled teas and fruit juices he'd acquired instead made competent substitutes, though. In Asgard, when they'd finished their picnic, they'd sat side by side and just enjoyed the view for a while, contemplating the brush with death they'd experienced the day before, and musing silently about what exactly they were to each other, which was not entirely clear to them at that time. Here, they didn't have to mull over either of those things. Instead, they made love on the mountainside, because they were on their honeymoon, and it seemed like the thing to do. And then Corwin took his turn at the wheel and drove them back to town. They had 3 hours at large before they were expected at Ming's, so they went back to the Phoenix house, grabbed a quick shower, and then let the afternoon unfold as it would. This ultimately took the shape of a long, leisurely cruise around the city, while Corwin pointed out favorite landmarks and old haunts, and unpacked as best he could the complicated history of his chief contact and best friend in this strange but nifty world. At one point, they drove right past the building where Caitlin and Juniper were, but of course they had no idea they had done so. At this time, Kate was inside having tea and a long, thoughtful conversation about the nature of the fighting arts with Master Ito, while Anne was up on the roof with Azana, far above the street, having a fine old time. The rooftop space of the Firebending Academy was about half-roofed itself, one end enclosed in a sort of three-sided cabana to keep off the worst of the weather on inclement days. The floor in this area was straw matting, better for kneeling and sitting than the slate flagstones in which the rest of the roof was clad. There was a rack full of neatly folded towels off to one side, a small table with a pitcher of water and a couple of cups in the corner, and the slightly incongruous red box of a first aid kit on the wall next to the stairs leading down into the building. Anne and Azana were in this area, practicing an elaboration on the basic fire punch Cora had taught Anne the night before last, in which the first strike was immediately followed by a second with the other hand. Azana was able to perform this maneuver with blinding speed, such that the two bolts of flame arrived almost as one. In Anne's case, it was more of a volley, but her impromptu instructor had good things to say about her technique, and, as she got into the groove and started really feeling the flow of the maneuver, her range. "Good," Azana declared, as Anne launched a firebolt clean across the roof, charring a neat hole in the center of a wooden target at the opposite edge. "Very good. Boy, you learn quickly. Maybe I will take you on. It'll be the easiest teaching job anyone ever had." Anne gave her a crooked smile, wiping sweat from her forehead. "I get the impression the learning curve for firebending gets steeper as you go up." "Ha, that's true," Azana agreed, grinning. She tossed Anne a towel, then coiled herself lithely into something like the lotus position on the straw-padded floor and gestured for her to have a seat opposite. Anne considered the way she was sitting and opted for Cezai instead. "Can I ask you something?" she said. "Sure," Azana said. "What's on your mind?" "If you're not an instructor and don't really want to be one, why are you here? Ito-sensei didn't seem to treat you like a student." Azana half-smiled. "I'm not a student anymore, at least not officially. This is where I learned most of what I know, though, and I like to come back and see what's going on. Grandfather gives me the run of the place, but, well, you've seen what he's like. He'd badger-mole me about my duty to the next generation of firebenders until the next comet day if I let him," she said with a fond smile. "Ito-sensei is your grandfather?" said Anne. "I guess that explains how you could get away with talking to him like that," she added wryly. Azana laughed. "Oh, he's like that with everyone," she said. "Some of the other instructors here are into discipline and protocol. I mean, you met Deng," she added. "But grandfather prefers students who speak their minds." "That may help," Anne mumbled, drawing another giggle, then said aloud, "Well, I appreciate you giving me a tryout, even if you did have your arm twisted." "It's no problem, honestly," Azana told her. "I grumble about it, but Grandfather does have a point. The future of the art is important. And being nagged to train a newbie or two sure beats the version of the same argument I always have with my mother when I see her," she added, rolling her amber eyes. "To hear her tell it, you'd think firebenders were on the verge of dying out, as if that's going to happen. Even the air nomads aren't in that kind of trouble anymore. There's, what, a couple hundred of them now?" She shrugged. "Anyway, Grandfather's version is a lot more compatible with my career," she added cheerfully. What do you do? Anne asked. Well, by night I'm the desk clerk at a fancy hotel, Azana replied, but my day job is professional bending. I'm the firebender for one of the local MLB teams, the Temple Island Fire Ferrets. So you see, having a firebending student is a perfectly valid training technique. She grinned and added, Maternity leave? Not so much. Drawing a laugh from Anne. Okay, break's over, said Azana, rising. Let's try a more complicated exercise. Work on some footwork. Anne was up for that, and before long they were out from under the cabana into the afternoon sunshine, their shoes scraping gently on the slates. Doing this kind of work on the roof of a building in the middle of a big city gave Anne a pleasant feeling of being back home. The rooftop dojo was easily her favorite part of the Christie Avenue townhouse she and Caitlin had moved into when they relocated to New Avalon. She would have had a hard time believing that kind of fresh air and sunshine were available in a big city before she saw it, and this was much the same. It was a cheerful space, with its potted plants in the corners and its neatly pointed red brick parapet. It's nice up here, she remarked, as they reached the front of the roof, turned as one, and started back toward the cabana. Nothing but the best for Fire Lord Zuko's own bending academy, said Azana with a smile, nodding toward the smaller copy of the Fire Lord's portrait hanging in the middle of the cabana's back wall that was the rooftop's only decoration apart from the plants. Was it really? Anne wondered. It's not just named after him? Azana shook her head. Oh no, it was founded by the man himself, sometime around 110. First firebending school in Republic City. He didn't operate it himself, of course, far too busy, but it has the royal endorsement, and he visited when he was in the city. It's said that he and Avatar Aang used to spar on this very roof. Are you related? To Aang, no. To Fire Lord Zuko, I don't think so, but it's hard to tell for certain. I was just thinking that you look a lot like him, Anne mused. Well, part of that is because there's not a lot of variation in what my people look like, said Azana. We tend to be dark-haired and fair-skinned, and among those of us who are firebenders, this eye color is very common. She half-smiled wryly. In a way, you're lucky you're not an obvious firebender. We haven't always had the best reputation. Even today, there are people who see my eyes and immediately get... She hesitated. Weird on me. It's no longer a guaranteed indicator of anything. The world's gotten a lot more cosmopolitan since his day, she went on, breaking the pattern long enough to indicate the portrait of Zuko. If you stay around town for a while, you'll hear Republic City called the melting pot that finished what the old coastal colonies like Yu Dao started. But realistically, it's been less than 2 centuries since the Hundred Year War. Some of the old hurts still linger, despite all that Zuko and Aang built after the war. Especially in the Earth Kingdom, there are still people who hate us, call us Ashmakers. Not that it's entirely undeserved, she admitted sadly. If you get out to Ba Sing Se sometime, check out the Wall Museum. Some of the stuff the Fire Nation got up to back then. She shook her head. Seriously crazy. I'm sorry, Anne said. I didn't mean to dredge up... Nah, it's okay, Azana replied. It's stuff you're going to have to know if you're going to be a firebender anyway. There's baggage attached. Then, brightening, she went on. Anyway, I don't think I'm related to good old Zuko, but I wouldn't mind if I was. He was a handsome devil. And you never know, she added with a grin. He lived a long time and did a lot of interesting things. She winked cheerfully, her good humor restored, and began the pattern again. Not all of them very well documented. Anne laughed. She was enjoying her lesson, and she had come to the conclusion that she liked Azana. She was unpretentious and easygoing, two traits that went a long way with someone as weary since childhood of pretense and martinetry as Anne Cross of Oron 4. Not hard to look at, either, though not really Anne's type. They worked on the more complicated pattern for another hour or so, until the lengthening shadows reminded Azana that she had to get ready for work. "All right, quitting time for today," she said, retrieving the towels they'd used earlier and handing Anne's to her. "For what it's worth, I'm with Cora on this one. You've got potential. How much longer are you in town?"
"A week, I think. Last I heard, the plan was to head home next Saturday."
Anne scrubbed at her hairline, then draped the towel around her neck. "If all goes well, I'll be coming back sometime in the middle of June."
"Hmm," said Azana.
They made their way down the stairs into the building, closing the trapdoor behind them.
"Well, that works for me. Spring training starts later this week, but it's a lot less regimented than the spring training in, say, baseball, so there'll be plenty of opportunities for us to keep exploring if you want. After that, I'll be pretty well tied up for most of April, with all the business involved in getting the season underway. But by mid-June, we should be into a pretty good groove. There'll be time to breathe. Be a good time for us to really get started if you want."
"That would be great," said Anne. "Well then, let's go talk to Grandfather and your sensei and see if we can set it up." She grinned and held the door at the bottom of the rooftop stairwell.
"Say, if you guys aren't doing anything Tuesday afternoon, you should come to Shinobi Arena. We've got our first spring training match at 4:30. Us against the Frostbite Point Ice Wraiths. Should be a good game."
"Sounds like fun," Anne agreed. Back on Air Temple Island, Sergei couldn't help but feel a bit miffed. He understood that he tended to make a sensation wherever he went. He couldn't help it if people weren't properly equipped to cope with his sheer awesomeness, but he was usually magnanimous enough to acknowledge that, yes, it could sometimes be a problem. Still, the place he and his mistress found themselves in at the moment seemed plenty peculiar enough to handle him. It never occurred to him that there might be animal control regulations in town, that it would take some time for Caitlin, even with the Avatar's help, to get into compliance with. All Serge knew was that she and Junie had gone into town and left him on the island, and now he found himself thoroughly bored. He considered swimming to the mainland and tracking them down. The latter wouldn't be that hard, but the former would probably take too long. It'd be just his luck to get there and then discover that they'd caught the ferry back while he was on his way over, and were now back on the island, wondering where he'd got to. Reluctantly, he discarded that plan. The young humans in the funny clothes had been a worthwhile diversion for a little while, but they were all busy doing whatever it was they were doing, and none of it made enough sense to Serge to remain interesting for long. The lemurs were no help at all. They just cleared out as soon as they spotted him coming, and he didn't care to chase them, as he was reasonably certain this would be misinterpreted by the people as well. As for the giant, shaggy creatures who lived in the caves, they were even less interesting than the humans. All they seemed to want to do was eat hay or sleep. By mid-afternoon, he'd been reduced to prowling the crags and corners of the island, looking for anything in any way diverting. Nothing was forthcoming, and Serge had just about resigned himself to going back to the bison caves and reconsidering his interest in sleep. He was on his way back there now, taking a shortcut across a little courtyard out in back of the women's quarters, when he at last smelled something interesting, and became aware a moment later that something interesting had smelled him as well. Another animal, not as enormous as the sky bison, but quite a bit bigger than Serge himself, emerged from a small outbuilding in the courtyard, snuffling the air. Undaunted as ever, Serge ambled over to say hello, trying as he did to catalog his new acquaintance. At first sight, he thought it, Serge corrected himself, she,
might simply be a colossal white dog. Her broad, blocky head reminded Serge of Buddy, the Labrador retriever who lived a few doors down from their old house on Tomodachi. But there was something bear-like about her giant stature and the way she carried herself. This remarkable creature seemed equally unconcerned about the appearance of a very large striped cat in her yard. She moseyed on over, still sniffing thoughtfully, until her nose nearly touched his. For a moment, they regarded each other impassively. Then the dog, bear, whatever she was, went back to her house and returned with a piece of meat, which she dropped in front of Serge, having correctly deduced that he was the only other carnivore on the island, since the Avatar, by long agreement with the management of the Air Temple, was one only when she was off the island. Serge regarded it for a moment. He wasn't terribly hungry, having had a substantial breakfast, but it did smell good, and the offer was exceedingly generous. So after a decent interval, he bowed his head graciously, picked up the meat, and neatly sheared it in two with his teeth, leaving the other half for his host. Having thus established full diplomatic relations, the two settled down to have a bit of late lunch together. "There she is again," Utina said suddenly. "Pardon?" said Corwin, who had been occupied with parallel parking the Coromobile in front of Ming and Daughter's clothiers. "The girl in the dark coat with the big shoulder bag," said Utina, gesturing with her head. Corwin set the handbrake, shut down the car, and looked where she was pointing. There was indeed a girl, standing on the corner a block or so further down, in a dark coat and carrying a shoulder bag. "Looks like she's waiting for the streetcar," Corwin observed, climbing out of the car. "So?" "This is like the fourth time I've seen her this afternoon," Utina said as Corwin came around and opened her door for her. "She was at the market, looking at those weird masks a couple of stalls down from Kemba's place. She was at the Beifong Memorial. She was at the Harmony Tower. And there she is again. I think she's following us." "Hmm," said Corwin, considering. "Well, could be. We're a pair of exotic strangers bombing around Republic City in Avatar Korra's very obvious car, and we did make a pretty big entrance at the Phoenix House last night. I expect we're a certain kind of news." Utina blinked. "You think she's a reporter?" "One way to find out," Corwin replied, then gave a big overhead wave toward the corner and called, "Excuse me, are you a reporter?" The girl visibly spooked like a startled horse, turning big eyes toward him. Then she sprang onto a passing streetcar and vanished inside it. "Subtle," said Utina. Corwin shrugged. "Must have a nervous disposition," he said. "Ah, well, let's get our couture on. I have to admit I've been looking forward to this." "Are you secretly a girl?" Utina wondered as she took his arm and they crossed the street to the shop. "I think you ought to know the answer to that by now," Corwin replied mildly. "But if you give me an hour or so, I'll be happy to arrange another demonstration." The staff of Ming and Daughter's clothiers appeared to consist of identical quadruplets, each wearing a very slight variation on the same very elaborate embroidered gown, and they were expecting their curious guests. When Utina and Corwin entered the shop, they were instantly separated, each taken to a different corner of the establishment by a pair of extremely polite young women, and then given the business. The next hour was a whirlwind of fittings, color selections, experimental style adjustments, sometimes with the client's input, usually without. Items were adjusted on the fly, occasionally with outright alterations performed by one of the daughters while the others briskly, efficiently selected accessories or refined the fit of some other bit of the ensemble.
Neither Corwin nor Utrina could see what was happening to the other. There were screens in the way. But there weren't any obvious sounds of mayhem coming from either corner. And besides, each was being kept far too busy to be that worried about the other for the moment. At the end of the hour, having had the opportunity to say perhaps a half dozen words apiece, they were brought back together in the front of the shop and herded out onto the sidewalk with much bowing and thanking for coming. Then the door closed behind them with a cheery jingle of its little brass bell, and there they stood, blinking bemusedly at each other. They were dressed to the nines, as they had been a few times before, the previous day, for instance, but in styles that were almost entirely new for them. Corwin's suit was of the very latest full formal cut, a style that had only lately emanated from the tastemakers of Ba Sing Se. A three-piece ensemble, its notch-fronted clawhammer jacket and sleekly creased trousers, a deep but faintly lustrous onyx black, with a high-collared white shirt and a silver-gray waistcoat that seemed to shimmer faintly, like quartz crystals in granite. Around his neck, one of the daughters had deftly knotted a silk cravat in a slaty storm sky blue, hearkening back to the water tribe roots she'd imagined he had. This color was echoed in the band of the low-crowned top hat they'd put on him, which, along with the midnight blue-lined Inverness cape draping his broad shoulders, made him feel slightly like Zatara the Magnificent. For Utrina's part, the brace of daughters who'd seen to her had apparently decided that, though she didn't resemble the women of the Fire Nation in any easily spotted way, that nation's style would suit her best. And Corwin believed they had been absolutely correct, because she looked frankly amazing, even by his extremely high baseline standards. The basis of the outfit was simple enough in principle, a sleek black sheath dress, ankle length but slit nearly to the waist on the right side. It was snug-fitting all the way to its notched mandarin collar, but sleeveless, its seams and edges a rich flame scarlet. Over it she wore a double mini-cloak in two shades of red, its darker outer layer covering her shoulders and about half of her upper arms, the inner layer, which matched the piping of her dress, barely visible in front, but reaching to her waist and back. They'd done something that put a little bit of a wave in her hair, too, changing it from the standard casual feathery tousle to a sort of Lauren Bacall look. Corwin ended up not saying about half a dozen different things before settling on, "You should do glamorous more often, because you do it really, really well." Utrina blushed slightly. "Thanks. My second dress in as many days," she quipped. "I'm going to develop a complex." Corwin grinned. "Relax," he said. "You look amazing. And besides, nobody's ever going to see you but me, the staff of this shop, everyone in the restaurant." There was a brilliant flash of light from across the street near the car. Without missing a single beat, Corwin went on matter-of-factly, "And the entire circulation of the Republic City Tribune, unless you intend to chase that girl down and make her disappear." "What? Hey!" Utrina cried, as the girl in the dark coat, now carrying what had probably been the contents of that bulky shoulder bag all along, a big old-fashioned press camera, darted away down the street. "If you do," Corwin added dryly, "please don't hurt the camera." He shook his head sadly. "I'm afraid I simply can't be in a relationship with a woman who would damage a Rolleiflex." Utrina thrashed out the matter in her head for a couple of seconds, her jaw working, and then threw up her hands with the sort of grin a gambler sports when going all in. "What the hell," she said. "Let's go to dinner." They saw the girl from the Tribune, if that's what she was. Since Corwin's remark about that paper's circulation, that was how they'd both mentally tagged her. Again outside Kwong's. Corwin was vaguely tempted to pretend he'd mistaken her for an employee and ask her to park the car. But Utena, who had apparently decided she liked the reporter's pluck, ordered him to leave the poor girl alone and let her do her job. Inside, the restaurant was elegance itself, easily the swankiest place they'd ever eaten in together. The staff were elegant and courteous without being obsequious, except the head waiter, but then that was part of his job. The food was excellent, and, unlike in most other fine dining establishments either of them had experienced before, the management wasn't shy about the portion size either. It was all very well calculated to leave the diner satisfied, but not so as to hamper whatever plans he or she might have for the remainder of the evening. While they ate, Corwin and Utena continued their discussion from earlier, this world and its peculiarities, how Corwin had come to know it, and how the person he'd come to know it through had entered his parents' lives in the first place. This, in its various nuances, was a story to rival even Utena's own, and that wasn't something she could say about everyone she encountered, even people who had lived so many times longer than she had. She had already decided that she liked Corwin's old friend Cora very much, but now she found herself admiring her as well, and not just for being a four-way, element-bending badass, though she had to admit that didn't hurt. After dinner, they adjourned to the Velvet Palanquin, which was a nightclub of the old school, similar in concept, if utterly different in execution, to the good old Cobalt Club back in New Avalon. The Palanquin's decor was relentlessly Asian, even by the standards of Republic City. Not really to Corwin's taste, nor Uchina's, though they had to admit the standards to which the place was built were impeccable. Besides, they weren't really there to admire the wall hangings and light fixtures. They were there to hear Baron Zoria and his circle of horns and dance for the second time in 2 days, and that was exactly what they proceeded to do. If Utena had been absolutely backed into a corner and forced to choose between the Circle of Horns or Captain Joe Hodgson and his Cobalt Orchestra, she would have had a very hard time making the decision. Both were excellent ensembles, fully capable of keeping her interested on a dance floor for as long as they cared to do. On balance, she liked the Cobalt's repertoire a little more. The Baron's crew occasionally wandered off into territory that was a little too experimental for her. On the other hand, they also had a wider range, occasionally going for straight-up Chicago blues and New Orleans hot jazz, where Captain Joe was strictly a big band man. "I don't wish to seem insecure," said Corwin, "but generally when I'm dancing with a woman and she's frowning like that, it's a sign I'm doing something wrong." "Huh? Oh, no. I just inadvertently set myself an impossible problem to consider," she said, explaining the train of thought she'd just been having. While she was doing so, the number they were dancing to ended. They made their way off the floor to one of the tables around its edge, and sat to catch their breath and have a drink. "Aha," Corwin said, nodding. "That is a tough one. Personally, I'd have to go with... "What?" Utena asked, seeing his own expression suddenly change to a thoughtful frown. She turned in her seat, following his eyeline back past the bar to the lobby entrance. "Well, I'll be damned," she added as she saw the kerfuffle happening there. It was the girl from the Tribune again, of course, and she seemed to have gotten into a spot of bother with the bouncer. For a second, Utena wondered what the problem was. She'd changed her clothes since they'd seen her outside Kwong's, and though not quite as dolled up as Utena and Corwin were, she should have been perfectly acceptable for the club. Not a bad-looking girl, in fact, in a green dress that was similar in cut to Utena's, but simpler and not as masterfully fitted, with short sleeves and long gloves instead of a mini-cape. "Maybe she's underage," Utena thought, though she doubted it. The drinking age in Republic City appeared to be 18, and though very young, the reporter didn't seem younger than that. Then Utrina caught a flash of metal, an object over which the girl and the bouncer seemed to be vying. She rose and headed toward them, reacting instinctively to the possibility, however remote, that it might be a weapon. Corwin was up and striding purposefully across the lobby, by that point too, half a step ahead of her. From behind, Utrina could see that his shoulders, their breadth accentuated by the cut of his jacket, were set for action. Even in this tense situation, the sight, and the fact that she knew him so well it was plain to her, made her smile a little. Then they'd reached the girl and the bouncer, and Corwin's voice cut across the argument like a whip crack.
"Are you insane? Don't break that!"
His hand flashed out and snatched the metal object from the bouncer's hand a moment after he, in turn, had wrested it from the girl's. Looking at it, Corwin nodded and went on, "This is a Minox A3S. Decisively, he snapped the mini-camera shut and stuck it in the inside pocket of his jacket. "It's probably worth more than you are," he told the bouncer.
"Mind your own business, pally," the bouncer told him, causing Utrina to not really suppress a little snort of laughter as Corwin's eyebrows went up.
"Pally? Really?"
23 Skidoo, my good hotman," he replied. "We'll take it from here."
The bouncer stood his ground, glowering, for a second or so. Then his eyes shifted to Corwin's left, saw that the woman who was with him was standing right there and looking equally up for a problem, if the bouncer wanted to make one, and made a give-me-strength kind of roll.
"Get her out of here,"
he growled, angling a beefy thumb toward the exit behind him.
"Her kind isn't welcome here."
"What a winning disposition you have," Utrina said sweetly. "I can see why you chose a profession that involves a lot of interacting with the public."
"Zap," mumbled Corwin delightedly, putting up a hand for her to high-five in a low-key sort of way.
The bouncer kept glaring for a second, then turned on his heel and stalked back to his station. Corwin smiled at him, then took the girl's elbow and started for the door. "Okay, come on. We've got maybe 5 minutes before Mr. Friendly calls the tinheads." She took her arm back, but kept walking with him and Utrina as they went outside.
"What century are you from?" she demanded once they reached the sidewalk. "Nobody's called them tinheads since the 180s.
Catching his arm, she turned him to face her and demanded, "Who are you?" Utrina grinned. "Now where would your sense of accomplishment be if we just told you?"
"Totally," Corwin agreed. He took the spy camera out of his pocket and put it in the reporter's hand.
"Here, be more careful with that. It's a classic. I dug your TLR earlier, by the way. You've got good taste in hardware." He smiled wryly. "Hopefully you're a decent hand with it. I don't want to open the trib tomorrow and find out you cut off my head getting her centered," he added with a nod toward Utrina. "She always gets all the attention when we go out. It's getting boring." Utrina nodded in agreement, then did a theatrical double take and said, "Wait, what?" When Corwin only waggled his eyebrows cheesily in response, Utrina sighed, fists on hips, and quipped, "It's not too late to unmarry you, mister." Corwin mock winced.
"Ixnay, not in front of the press," he said urgently.
Then, turning to the reporter again, he said,
You are with the press, right, and not just some random loon?"
"For the record, I'll feel really silly if that turns out to be the case," Utrina put in. "I've been kind of rooting for you this whole time." The girl blinked at them as if trying to decide whether they were dangerously crazy or just attractively so.
"Without really knowing quite why,"
She wasn't required to in circumstances like this. She produced her press card. Emily Wong, Republic City Tribune.
Ha, said Corwin. I told you she was from the Tribune. She's way too classy to be one of those creeps from the United Daily News.
Okay, so look, said Utena. Why are you following us around? Why are we news?
Emily gave her an incredulous look.
Are you kidding me? You showed up out of nowhere on a sky bison, and you're obviously not air nomads. You're in the Avatar suite. You're driving the Avatar's car. You've been all over town today, and look at you.
She folded her arms and gave Utena a challenging look.
People are wondering about you. That's sort of the definition of news.
Told you, Corwin remarked.
Hush, you. I'm working an angle here, said Utena.
Corwin nodded.
Yes, ma'am. Carry on.
Thank you.
Putting her arm around Emily's shoulders, Utena steered her gently off the sidewalk, explaining as she did so,
Okay, I got an idea. We're not going to tell you anything. We'll go on being just as mysterious as before. In fact, we'll play it like we never even noticed you.
How does that help me in any way? Asked Emily skeptically.
Are you kidding? Utena replied. With a little industry, you can keep this going for days. Your editor will be on the edge of his seat. And when the payoff finally comes, and it will, if you trust us, you'll be number one with a bullet on the Tribune Society page. Play your cards right, that could take you anywhere.
She stopped, turned to face the reporter, and grinned conspiratorially at her.
Are you in?
Emily eyed her warily.
You're crazy.
That accusation is not unfamiliar to me, Utena agreed, then repeated,
Are you in?
The young reporter looked from her to Corwin and back again a couple of times, then grinned and returned.
Heck yeah, she said. Whatever you're up to, it sure beats covering cotillion balls.
Excellent. Then we have a deal. Utena gestured to Corwin. We're going to do what we do. You're going to cover it without getting in our faces too much, and sometime next week we'll tie it all together.
She clouted Emily companionably on the shoulder.
Have a lovely rest of your evening. We plan to, and don't take any wooden nickels.
Turning, she started back toward Corwin, then paused and turned back to add in exactly the same friendly tone of voice.
Oh, and if I find you in the closet tonight when I go to hang up my dress, I will defenestrate you. Just so we're clear.
Emily giggled.
You're okay there, she assured Utena. I have limits.
Good to know.
Utena made the duelist curtsy bow to her. Behind, Corwin threw her the Water Tribe salute, just to stir the pot a little more. She looked momentarily puzzled, then replied Earth Kingdom fashion before retreating down the street.
You're brilliant, Corwin told Utena as she rejoined him.
Thank you, I believe I am, she agreed cheerfully, giving him a kiss. Out of the corner of her eye, she picked up the blink of a camera flash.
Okay, kid, you earned that one, she murmured wryly.
Then she took Corwin's arm, and they went back into the velvet palanquin.
Sunday, March 14th, 2410. Breakfast on Air Temple Island, and all the gang were there this time. Cora, Caitlin, Anne, and Anthy, all gathered at the corner table in the Air Temple refectory, where Cora usually ate when she was on the island. This morning they'd been joined by Nima and her elder sister Lakpa, and Anthy had to acknowledge, if only internally, that she saw Nima's point now. She still didn't agree that the younger sister was ugly, but Nima's charm was a much more nuanced thing, brought out by animation rather than repose.
Lokva, who was 2 years older than Nima, was more attractive in the conventional sense. The proportions of her face and body were more classically harmonious, and her long dark hair didn't hurt either. Though, Anthy reflected, she would lose that, at least temporarily, when and if she attained her own mastery of airbending. Paradoxically, though, Lokva seemed less at ease with herself than Nima. She seemed a little smug about being the pretty one. But underneath it, Anthy sensed a certain need to be agreed with on that point, to be reassured that she really was. It made her not a bully, exactly, or cruel, but she did seem to treat her younger sister a shade more harshly than anyone else, making remarks to her that would have been offensively cutting to anyone else. Nima didn't seem to mind. Anthy suspected it had been going on for so long she barely noticed anymore. It reminded her a little of how the Kaworu twins had been, during that phase when they hadn't been enemies anymore, but hadn't quite learned how to be friends either. That was a little bit sad, but at the same time, she had to admire the aplomb with which Nima handled it. The six of them were all chatting in a quiet, friendly way over their waffles and fruit. At the end of the table, Cora was flipping idly through the morning edition of the Republic City Tribune. She'd started with the sports page, as was her wont, and then worked her way through the rest of the paper, bringing various items to the others' attention as she went. This appeared to be a long-standing habit, about which no one found cause to remark. This went on until she reached the front page of the paper's fourth section, Around Town. Then the flow of commentary from her end of the table stopped, and she just sat there, coffee cup in one hand, paper in the other hand, perusing the page with an intent expression. Anne noticed the silence first, looked up, and saw the corner of Cora's right eye twitch, then the corner of her mouth. Then the avatar burst out laughing, causing everyone in the room to look up from what they were doing for a moment. The other airbenders and acolytes dismissed the phenomenon almost immediately and went back to their breakfasts. Cora's table mates sat looking curiously at her. Still chuckling, she turned the paper around and held out the Section 4 front page, saying, "Check this out." The six columns of text covering the bottom third of the page were too small for anyone but Anthy, who was right next to her, to read, but everyone could perfectly well see the stack of headlines above it. These started out in the kind of gigantic font usually reserved for major historical events, then worked their way down through several scale reductions in the subheads. "Who are they? Glamorous mystery couple take Republic City by storm. They came on a sky bison," say hotel witnesses. "Avatar Museum officials offer no comment on couple's possession of classic Satomobile. Can that possibly be her real hair? Exclusive photographs by our correspondent, Emily Wong." Above all this, naturally, was a large picture of Uchina and Corwin, dressed to kill and evidently standing on the sidewalk in front of a shop somewhere in the city. They seemed to be discussing something, not aware of the camera. She was smiling wryly, her hands open at waist height in front of her, and he was giving her a boyish grin, left thumb casually hooked in his waistcoat pocket, his right arm in the process of slipping around her waist. "Ha!" said Caitlin, delighted. "Oh, wow. Is that what Corwin looks like now?" Lokva asked. "He's amazing, and so's his girl." She elbowed her sister. "Right, Nima?" "I'm sure I don't know," Nima mumbled, reddening. "Lokpa," said Cora with a tone of friendly warning in her voice. Then she cleared her throat, fluffed the paper, and began to read the text of the article to the rest of them. "Republic City, Sanyue 13th," she read. "A mysterious pair of glamorous figures made a dramatic entrance to this city Friday night.
Witnesses told this reporter that the couple arrived at the Ultra Grand Phoenix House Hotel aboard an Air Nomad Sky Bison, which, should be who, surely, then departed without them in the direction of Air Temple Island. She skimmed a bit more of the article, which seemed to be a general précis of what Corwin and Utrina had been up to on Saturday morning and afternoon. The reporter seemed particularly taken by the fact that the mystery pair were staying in the Phoenix House's Avatar suite, and that they appeared to be driving the Avatar's own historic Sato-mobile, which sources had confirmed was missing from its place in the Avatar Museum. The management and staff of the Phoenix House, exercising their world-famous discretion, declined to comment on the couple's identities or what, if any, connection they have to the Avatar, she concluded. This correspondent will keep pursuing the story, as there is little doubt that the whole town wants to know, who are these people? She lowered the paper. Bunch more pictures behind the jump, including a nice one of them making out in front of the Velvet Pal, she added with a slightly wicked grin. Kate held out a hand. Cora closed the paper and handed it down to her. That's a great picture of them on the front, Anne observed. Yes, it is, Anthea agreed. Cora, do you think the paper would sell me a proper print of that one? I'd like to have it for their wedding album. Possibly some of the others as well, she added with a wry little smile as Kate opened to the jump. I think that can be arranged, Cora agreed cheerfully. Then she got out a small metal object that Anne realized was a mobile phone, if mobile phones had been invented by the people responsible for the design language of Jedi lightsabers. Cora's looked like it was supposed to be part of a set, with the lightsaber owned by Utrina's Jedi master friend, Atin Vey Springsteen. Still grinning, Cora thumbed a speed dial button, then put the phone to her ear. Hey, Chiang. Yep, I saw. Yeah, I know them. Remember Corwin Ravenhair? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not so little anymore. Look, they're going to be in town for the next week or so. No, he's not working on the Comet case with me. He's on his honeymoon. It won't be like the Tsunami Blue thing. Promise. Okay? Good. Now what I need is for you to grab 20 copies of this morning's Trib and stockpile them for later. Then keep track of the news stories involving them. The Trib's put one of their society page cub reporters on it. Girl name of Emily Wong. You know her? Uh-huh. I thought she came across that way. I don't know. Just something about the way she writes her copy. She sounds determined. Heh. Yeah. When she calls you, and she will, just give her the usual boilerplate. Ha ha, exactly. Why give him anything for free? Let's see how good she is. Be sure to get extra copies of those papers, too. Got it? Good, good. One more thing. The Wong girl's a photographer, too. Pretty good one. There are some nice shots with today's article, and we'd like them for the album. Can you get a hold of Min over in the Trib photo office and see if she'll shoot us a set of archive prints? Awesome. Call me if anything weird comes up. Well, more so than usual. Thanks. You're a pal. Bye. Switching off the phone, Cora put it down and said, There. Situation managed. Do you have a press agent? Kate asked. That's what that sounded like. I sure do, Cora said ruefully. Or rather, the White Lotus does. When I first started out as a public figure, I needed a lot of adult supervision, which I didn't always put up with, she added with a wry grin. I was the first Avatar who really had to deal with a news cycle less than 48 hours long, and I, didn't, really, at first. Someone decided my image needed a little managing. That was a long time ago, though. Nowadays, we do a lot more working together. Chiang's actually the Master Lotus I have the least trouble with. Unlike some of them, she added with a dark glance toward the far table where Jinora and her siblings sat.
He makes my life easier.
That's a cool phone, said Anne, hoping to steer the conversation away from something that plainly still annoyed Cora.
You like it?
Cora said, smiling.
It's a Gearphone 3. A couple of the engineers at SCM, the electronics division of Future Industries,
customized it for me, she explained.
Not their fanciest model. The Gearphone 5 came out last month. It does everything but steam Bowsie.
The 3's a rugged little beast, though, and that's more what I need. This one's got all the latest security features. No more late-night prank summonings to volcanoes that aren't erupting for this avatar.
She sighed. That's something none of my predecessors had to put up with either.
Corwin sloped into the Avatar Suite's sitting room, still in the act of pulling a sweatshirt adorned with the logotype of a Neo-Russian motorcycle manufacturer over his head, to find Uchina sitting on the couch reading. This wasn't that surprising. A standard issue of the Phoenix Flight book had, as promised, been waiting for them when they got in last night, but by that point they were prepared to do absolutely nothing apart from crash mightily. What was surprising was that she wasn't reading the book, which lay on the coffee table in front of her. She was instead regarding a sheet of paper, or had been until she noticed him entering the room.
Hey, she said, smiling. You just missed your girlfriend.
Corwin arched an eyebrow.
You're going to have to be more specific, he said dryly, taking a seat at the other end of the couch, then added in an affectedly world-weary tone,
One has so many.
Uchina rolled her eyes.
You're all that, she agreed. Azana, the night clerk. She stopped by before heading home to give us this.
She handed him the paper. It was covered in Tongyu writing, apart from a couple of what looked like pen and ink drawings of vintage racing cars and exciting action poses, replete with speed lines, cartoony clouds of dust, and improbable camber angles.
Seems to be a flyer for something.
Uchina frowned as a thought came to her.
Say, why can't the lens translate stuff in other languages? You should get your mom working on that.
Corwin looked up from the flyer, meeting her eyes.
You know, you're right. I totally should. That's a great idea.
He picked up the phone from the end table, dialed zero, and said, Hi, Corwin Ravenhair here. I need to send a telegram. 2 minutes later, with Uchina giggling in the background, he hung up and returned his attention to the flyer.
There. Now, let's see what we have here. You're right, it's a flyer.
For a car show? Uchina hazarded, based on the illustrations.
Corwin grinned. Better, a race. The Future City Historic Grand Prix.
Uchina slid across the couch and leaned against his shoulder, looking at the race car cartoons again.
I like the contradiction there, she said.
I know, right? It's where Future Industries is. The company's so big its headquarters has its own little city around it.
Oh, like Yamazaki City on New Japan.
Corwin nodded.
Exactly.
Said Uchina. Bet the city council doesn't enforce the industrial regulations too diligently.
Are you kidding? Corwin replied. Their workplace accident rates are the lowest in the United Republic.
Anyway, it's a vintage motor race. Azana probably figured we'd be interested because of the Coromobile. They run racing cars from about that same period.
I went to the one in... Geez, 03, I think.
When is it? Uchina wondered.
Corwin checked the small print.
3 o'clock this afternoon. Usually runs about 2 hours.
Think we'll be done with the History Museum by then?
Could do, Corwin said agreeably. Though if we want to try it, we'd better head out now.
1943 Technology Drive, Nekomikoka Tomodachi. Skulled Ravenhair was watching cartoons because she was a grown woman and nobody could stop her, when the doorbell rang. Puzzled, she paused the show and got up to answer the door. She found there a young boy in the uniform of the Tomodachi Bell Corporation, the conglomerate that handled most of Tomodachi's telecommunications traffic, holding a small yellow envelope. He asked her whether she was Skulled Ravenhair. When she said she was, he handed her the envelope, bowed, turned, mounted his bicycle, and sped away. Puzzled, Skulled turned the envelope over in her hand, then tore off the end, removed a slip of paper from inside, and laughed. She hadn't realized Tomodachi Bell even did telegrams anymore, but here was one. Based on the codes printed on the back, it had been relayed through ZTT and Saikyo to Tomodachi Bell's central office downtown, but had originated in Republic City, which meant she was reasonably sure who it came from before she turned it over and read the message itself. Auto-translate function a la Gift of TARDIS for next LensOS rev, stop. Can't believe you didn't think of years ago, stop. CWCD, Utena's idea, stop. Brilliant, but we knew that, stop. Love, Corwin, end it. She said, rereading the message thoughtfully. Then, turning to go back into the house, she tucked it into the top pocket of her shirt and mused, "That is brilliant."